John Fogerty, the creative genius behind Creedence Clearwater Revival. Do you have any memories of playing Hellholes?
Yeah, I there's got to be an old Don Rickles line there somewhere. You know, I don't know. I've certainly closed a lot of toilets, I think, in my life. You know, you look back at those things kind of fondly, always presuming that you are never going back there, of course.
Congrats on getting the music back. That was like a 50-year nightmare, right?
Yeah, it was basically my whole adult life trying to get the songs back. And of course, when I signed the original piece of paper that put this in motion, at that time it meant songs that I hadn't even written yet were going to be owned by these people. Yeah, it's a really bizarre situation. Thank God for me, at least, and my family, I finally got the ownership of my own songs back.
All of those Creedence songs were recorded in a span of like 4 years. That's insane.
Yeah, I was a pretty busy songwriter, that's for sure.
Like, you made it look easy and effortless.
You know, I had never been a success before. You know, that was still on the other side of the mountain from me. So anything to do with the actual musical success was only a fable, a dream that you were trying to accomplish. So, you know, the only thing you know when it hasn't happened yet for you is you just got to keep working harder. And that was something I could do. And said, well, what's our situation here? Gee, we're on a tiny label. We don't have a manager. We don't have a publicist. In other words, we really don't have any of the things that big bands like obviously the Beatles have. And I said, I guess I'm just going to have to do it with music. And I vowed to work as hard as I could.
When you got the call for Woodstock, did you know this was going to be Woodstock, or did you think it was just another music festival?
Well, actually, you know, we had begun that this was 69, of course. And in that spring of that year, I began this. We were touring pretty, you know, crazily by then. And every time we would come to the East Coast, I would see these billboards that said, come to Woodstock, 3 days of peace, love, there was another word, I can't remember what that was, and I had the little, you know, bird sitting on the guitar, and what's up with this Woodstock thing, you know? And finally, I started to hear about artists that were going to appear there, and I said to myself, well, I want to be involved in that. That sounds like something cool. I've been very surprised in the years since then, of course, that I, you know, they say that Creedence was the first band signed to be at Woodstock, and that everything fell into place after that. I think there's even a plaque at the Woodstock in Bethel Museum there. That's sort of a surprise to me, because I felt that they had already gotten other people to sign. Maybe they hadn't signed up yet. Maybe
you're like, wait, what? I've been duped.
Wait, I thought all these other people were going to play.
Where'd they go?
Yeah, exactly.
How old were you in 1969?
I turned 24 that year in May.
Wow.
But, so, you know, I don't think anybody realized it would become some cultural event. I don't even think anyone realized that it would cause such a traffic jam and the massive amount of people going there. You know, there were a few. That was kind of the summer of festivals. There had been, I think, Monterey Pop in 67, and there were a few in 68. And then it really got rolling almost every weekend. It seemed like there was a festival somewhere.
Just but felt like another festival, or did you know because of who was there that this one was special?
Well, I know I wanted to do a good job. We were actually flying from the West Coast on Friday night, having spent a week doing the Andy Williams show.
Andy Williams.
So I actually had to fly overnight on the red eye. But we were already getting phone calls from our advance people that, well, there's big traffic jams here. Everybody's just leaving their car in the middle of the road. I couldn't quite believe that. I mean, when somebody says that and it's never happened, it's kind of unbelievable. And then when we get there, we find out it's really true. But of course, by then we're inside the perimeter, and I didn't realize the impact that it was having on television outside in the rest of the world.
You know, when you looked out to this audience and there's this massive sea of people, is that more intimidating or is it all the artists that you respect behind you backstage?
I would say that, you know, because of all the traffic being clogging the roads, they had to take us on to the site by helicopter. And this, it was only a two-man helicopter, meaning there was one pilot and then two passengers. And it was a really small, it seemed to me to be a World War II helicopter with a plastic bubble,
oh.
You know.
Over oh, yeah. Yeah. No door.
Yep.
Yeah, no door, exactly. And I just know that my feeling that day when the helicopter's going across kind of a wooded area, it took probably 10 minutes all told, but suddenly it comes up over a hill and you look down into the bowl of what we all call Woodstock, Yazgur's farm there, and it was full of people. I mean, that was awe-inspiring. I mean, it took my breath away. I could not even comprehend what I was looking at. There were so many people. So that was intimidating, or it certainly got your attention.
Oh, yeah. Right. That's a moment.
And I don't know how much you know of the result, but I certainly wanted to do a good job and have a really good set in front of all those people. You know, the star of Creedence Clearwater was really on the rise, and I wanted to make have a good impression. So you probably know the story that lo and behold, come Saturday when we were supposed to play at 9 o'clock, it was supposed to be a headlining position, but everything was sort of chaotic and running late and all that sort of thing, and it seemed a little disorganized, to say the least. We were told the Grateful Dead was going on ahead of us. Oh, okay. But what we didn't know is that the Grateful Dead then sort of had a meltdown. And truth be told, we found out many, many years later, they had all taken LSD mm-hmm. as they walked up to be on stage in front of 500,000 people. And so they kind of got a bit, you know, confused on stage. And there were long periods of time when they weren't playing. So what happened to all those 500,000 people had been through, you know, pretty trying circumstances where it rained and rained the day before. They were all muddy, sitting in the big, you know, on dirt on a hillside, and they were tired. And so with all those gaps in, with the music stopping, they fell asleep. And so by the time I came out on stage, you know, I was raring to go, man. I wanted to set the woods on fire, but by and large, those people were asleep. And that was very frustrating.
Wow. Because right. When you see the footage of you guys, it's, like you said, you're lighting it on fire. Like, you guys are rocking. You guys are there to make a statement.
The statement was wake up.
That's right. Well, we finally got them up after about 20 minutes or something like that. People, I always used to say, well, we warmed them up for Janice. It was just one of those, it was something I was really kind of counting on, you know, with a big audience like that. So I just was very frustrated for years after that because it caused a lot of tension even in my band. I decided not to have, they were going to use our cut of Bad Moon Rising. That's all they were going to show. And while we were playing that, people were asleep. And I just thought, you know what, that's okay.
Yeah.
I don't need to be in your movie.
So you guys get done and then Janis Joplin comes on?
Oh, yeah, and she was smoking.
Did you stay for that? Did you watch that?
I stayed and watched Janis and then a little bit of Sly and the Family Stone. I had no idea how late it really, really was. That had to be 3:30. Years later, I mean, I was always hearing about The Who and The Who playing and that Pete Townsend had kind of booted Abbie Hoffman off their stage, you know, and it also said, well, they played Saturday night. And I kind of never really referenced it until maybe 10 years ago. I started to go, well, wait a minute, I was on Saturday night. I didn't see The Who. When did this happen? And so when that whole complete album finally came out, we realized The Who was on at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning, actually.
Damn.
And that's when all of that happened. You know, Woodstock kind of was a 24-hour, 24/7 event there. It just kept going around the clock.
John, can I name a song and maybe you can tell us a story about writing it or what the inspiration behind the song was?
Sure, of course.
Proud Mary?
Oh, wow. Well, you've hit a really cool one. It ended up that Proud Mary was really the first good song that I wrote. It was the early summer of 1968. Susie Q was out and it was doing well and on the radio, and I was already trying to get ready for what would come after, you know. So I was working on writing songs, and I was still in the Army Reserve, but I was trying to get relieved of my duty or figure out a way where I could have a rock and roll career and maybe show up. I was just not able to figure out a blend, you might say, that was going to work. And so I think it was June or July of 68. Anyway, I found on the steps to my little apartment my honorable discharge from the Army. And if you were any kid that was of draft age right about that time, you know how important that piece of paper was. I was overjoyed. I was thrilled because it meant I could go forward with my rock and roll career. And I kind of let out a wahoo and did a little cartwheel on the grass out in front of my apartment house. I ran inside, grabbed my guitar, and started strumming. And basically within about 35, 40 minutes, had written Proud Mary, or, you know, pretty much maybe 95% of it. Starting with the first line, left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day. Well, you know, that you could see where that came from.
Yep.
Yeah.
And by the time I was sitting there with the song almost complete, sitting there holding the piece of paper for Proud Mary, and I was literally shaking. I said, wow, this is a classic. John, you've written a really good song.
Wow.
It was an amazing thing to have happened, because it never happened before, of course. And I never knew if I was capable of doing that. You have your dream, you have the people you admire, but you know, if you know what I'm saying, you never really know if you're going to be that guy or not.
Lightning struck.
Yep.
I could keep you all day. I don't want to do that. I just thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Yes, thank you.
Big honor to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's an honor for me, too.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.